Morning. Our first case today is number 24-1908, Roshana Ransom against Great Plains Finance. Mr. Smith?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Robert Roy Smith with Kilpatrick on behalf of Great Plains Finance, LLC. With me is my colleague, Mark Reeves, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Great Plains challenges the district court's application of the breakthrough management standard to the facts.
You think the breakthrough standard is the correct standard to apply. Why?
I do, Your Honor. It's for a couple of reasons. One, no circuit court to have considered breakthrough has rejected it. The Fourth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits have all followed the Tenth Circuit's lead and applied breakthrough, as have two state Supreme Courts, the Supreme Courts of Connecticut and California. And I think the reason for that is that breakthrough provides a qualitative and holistic framework for reviewing whether a tribal business entity is entitled to immunity.
So there are factors. It's not a test per se, and it's not numerical counting. It's a holistic approach.
That is correct.
It's subjective and holistic and evaluative, not rigid and numerical.
It is all those things, Your Honor, and not one factor weighs more heavily than any of the others.
And it's possible one factor could be so predominant that even if the other four go the other way, that one factor could carry the day.
Conceivably, yes, Your Honor.
Right, but it's open to us, even if we adopt that test to decide how to apply it. We could apply it stringently. We could require that most of the factors weigh that way, et cetera. We don't have to apply it as a 50-50. Are these facts all of equal importance, or are there a few we should really care most about?
Well, Your Honor, that's a great question. So the way breakthrough has been applied more recently, for example, is sort of to consider that sixth factor mm-hmm. that looks at the purposes of tribal sovereign immunity as really overlapping and informing the prior five, right? So already courts seem to be moving away from a six-factor test to a five-factor test. And I think since this is a question of first impression for this court, you can look to your jurisprudence on arm of the state immunity to help inform your decision-making on arm of the tribe immunity, right? I know, Judge Bevis, you were on a panel a couple of years ago in the Patterson case that dealt with arm of the state immunity. And there, right, this court has looked at the creation of the entity, right, whether it was created as a matter of state law, so here tribal law, the autonomy that the entity exercises, from the state or from the tribe, and then sort of who bears the responsibility for the judgment. So I think those seem to be the key factors.
That is one of the really important facts in arm of the state, Karn versus Shanahan. And here, the tribe is not on the hook. This is a separate entity. It's not going to hit the tribe's fist. Isn't that a hugely important strike against your argument?
No, because it does directly impact the tribe's finances. Any profits that Great Plains earns mm-hmm. goes to the tribal government.
Okay, but can that factor be determined without some record of what actually goes to the tribe from this enterprise?
It can, Your Honor, because the way other courts have interpreted breakthrough is not by looking at the exact amount of profits that
we don't have any amount. The record doesn't appear to show any amount. It talks about 20%, but 20% of what?
Right. So the record does not reflect an exact amount of profits.
So should the district court have made a determination as to what profits flowed?
No, because what matters under breakthrough is the entitlement to profits. So any and all profits that Great Plains realizes are provided to the tribe through the tribe's economic development entity, IMDG. And other circuits have rejected.
But that's theoretical. I think what Judge Fisher is getting at, if I read him right, is that we're interested in the actual revenues, not the theoretical revenues. And we don't really have any insight into that here.
Right. Well, the actual profits, with all due respect, don't matter for determining arm of the tribe immunity. And that's because you can look at what the Fourth Circuit said.
How do we know if there's any profits flowing from?
There doesn't have to be. There doesn't have to be, Your Honor. So
if the whole thing's a shell game, you're just as entitled to tribal immunity as if it's meaningful and there are a steady stream of profits that actually flow to the tribe?
No, not at all, Your Honor. And that's not what I'm saying. So when you look at some of the cases that have considered breakthrough and looked at arm of the tribe immunity, right, you have the internet lending cases from California. The court there looked at those tribal entities and said, these are actually a financial detriment to the tribe, but still found that those entities met the second factor of Great Plains, second factor of breakthrough for supporting immunity. Similarly, we cite in our briefs to the Eastern District of Virginia case, Applied Sciences from 2020, where the court was reviewing a tribal entity that had yet to distribute any profits to the tribe and still found that the second factor favored immunity for those tribal entities because Great Plains' purpose is to support economic development and opportunities for the tribal government and its members.
Let's grant
and it
that
does the purpose.
I think what is motivating the questions for my colleagues, and maybe I can't speak for them, is there's private equity lurking in the background here. They took control, they dropped control. They structured the agreement. The agreement is such that the amount of fees going to them appears to be so much that no money has yet reached the tribe. Your friends on the other side, I think their overarching argument and theme is this is a rent-a-tribe arrangement, right? So why shouldn't we apply factors 3 and 5? Even if factor 2 and 1 are met, and let's grant spot you 1 and 2, 3 and 5 in such a way to say, look, private equity, they're lurking in the background here, they're using and abusing this. Shouldn't that be an impermissible level of structuring, control, involvement, siphoning off, even if all the residual profits, if there eventually are some, go to the tribe?
Well, I take issue with my friend's use of the phrase rent-a-tribe. It is paternalistic at best and suggests that the tribe is unable to operate this business without some third-party involvement. With respect to the lending facility, as was pointed out by the amicus in this case, the lending facility does not contain terms that are uncommon in commercial lending. And what the credit facility for Great Plains provides the lenders is not day-to-day control over operations, even during that temporary event of default. What it provided the lenders was security for their collateral. And control over the business and security for collateral are two very different things. And in the Williams case before the Fourth Circuit, the court there was looking at a very similar lending facility that also gave the lender actual day-to-day management control and strategic decision-making. And the Fourth Circuit still found that the third breakthrough factor only weighed slightly against immunity. And here we don't have those additional elements of control.
You've got the burden of satisfying the breakthrough test. I see you nodding. That's a
correct.
Yes.
Correct, Your Honor.
And in terms of factual record, will you concede that Great Plains hasn't distributed any profits to the tribe or to Island Mountain thus far?
I do not concede that. I believe the record reflects that there have been profits distributed to IMDG.
You have established that in the factual record. Can you cite me where in the factual record that you've shown that Great Plains has distributed profits to the tribe or to Island Mountain? Because you just conceded, you got the burden to show it.
Yeah, I believe that is contained in the declaration of Evan Azure,
right,
that was submitted before
your,
the court.
Your colleague can look this up, and on rebuttal, you can give me the citation.
Sure. Happy to, Your Honor. So I do want to talk about the event of default for a moment, because that was a deciding factor for the district court. And the district court misunderstood the event of default in some very important ways. First, I think it's important to note that the event of default was not in place when Ms. Ransom filed this lawsuit. And it was also not in place when we moved for reconsideration.
It was in place at the time the court made the decision.
It was, Your Honor, but it was not once we moved for reconsideration,
okay.
Which
so
is important.
It's not in effect, but it's still there in the background. It's hanging over their heads.
That's speculative. The court was required to look at
before. It could happen again, right?
And isn't it true that the change of control or management provision in the loan agreement provides that the removal of a single Island Mountain board member can trigger an event of default?
That is what the agreement says. I would say
it's a pretty easy trigger.
It is an easy trigger, but I think when you look at the events of that surround the original event of default, right? I would argue that shows actually evidence of tribal control as opposed to the contrary. The tribal council can and did change the management of Great Plains despite what the credit facility said and over the objection of the administrative agent. That is evidence of direct tribal control by the tribal council. The other factor about the event of default that we have to keep in mind is that sovereign immunity is an ongoing inquiry, right? That's from the 10th Circuit in the Iowa Tribe case. And the Colorado Supreme Court has sort of taken that a step further and said that tribal sovereign immunity is trapped in the present. So the inquiry is now. So when the district court on reconsideration, pardon me?
When is now?
Well, now would be the facts that are the most current facts before the court on the record. Courts do split on this, and we acknowledge this in our briefing. There are some courts that say, well, we need to sort of look at the record at the time the complaint was filed. Other courts say, well, it's sort of trapped at the time of the motion to dismiss hearing, right? But under either formulation, the district court got it wrong. The district court relied on a post-suit event of default to limit Great Plains immunity, and then refused to consider the post-suit waiver of that event of default to support immunity. And that's inconsistent and that's erroneous.
Okay, what you talked about the district court applied the test improperly, applied the factors improperly, and you mentioned a couple. What general tenor would you say was improper about the way in which the court applied the factors?
Overly restrictive, Your Honor. When you look at how—
What does that mean, though?
Well, it means that when you look at the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, how those courts have applied breakthrough, they are willing to accept, for example, the stated purpose of the entity and not look any further than that, not look to see how the entity fulfills that purpose, but rather they just look for the plain language of the purpose as stated in tribal law. So the court went beyond, far beyond what other courts have done in applying the breakthrough standards. I see my time is up. I want to make sure I answered your question, Your Honor. Yes, we respectfully ask that you reverse the district court and remand for dismissal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Basinski?
That's good. thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Daniel Basinski of Counsel with Kim Law Firm, representing the appellee, Mrs. Ransom. I want to address, first off, a question that was asked about GPS profits and whether any of them are shared.
Before you get into the details of the case, can you tell us whether you disagree with anything that was said between your friend and us regarding the relevant standard that we're to apply here?
I agree that the burden is on GPF to prove that it is an arm of the tribe. I think that while the breakthrough factors provide a good skeleton for reviewing whether an entity should be considered an arm of the tribe, I agree with Your Honor that there are factors that should be considered more important than others in the test. I think there are the first factor, the control or the creation factor, the intent factor, even the stated purpose factor. I think those put form over function. Obviously, they're relevant to the analysis, but to have three of those factors relate to paperwork, more or less, I think.
One, two, and four are manipulable. Three and five are kind of functionally what are driving the train here.
I agree with that. And I think three and five really go to the underlying purpose behind tribal immunity, which is we don't want to invade the sovereignty of the nation, cultural autonomy, the purpose behind commercial dealings between non-Native Americans and Native Americans. And I think that those three
are
factors—
You're essentially saying control and financial relationship.
I think they need to be the predominant factors okay. In the analysis, because they are not as easy to manipulate as some of the others. Competent counsel will be able to create an articles of organization that creates the entity under tribal law, has the correct stated purpose, has the intent to share tribal immunity. And if that's half the factors, some courts are going to look at that, especially if they only adopt the first five factors of the breakthrough test and
we
say,
we should not just be counting up the number of factors.
Exactly.
How about focusing in on tribal control? Seems to me, looking at the structure, that the tribe has very tight control over this operation, even though they may not be getting profits distributed to them on an annual basis.
Yes, yeah, so I would disagree with that position, Your Honor. What they have is they have created this entity, and they have created some guidelines on how tribal lending is supposed to be handled. But if you look at the history of GPF, it's been managed primarily by non-tribal entities. And the only period of time where it was managed by IMDG was a 5 or 6 year period where the tribe didn't have access to financial records, apparently didn't know about third-party lending agreements, such as the Newport funding agreement with GPF. And it was a period of time that, and these are the tribe's own statements, was a period of time of unexplained debts and evidence of potential serious internal financial improprieties. This is very similar, though less egregious, than the fact pattern the California Supreme Court took a look at in People versus Miami Nation, where there was a 5 year period of time there that the tribe had internal disputes over control of the lending agency. And the court said that's sufficient on its own to find that there isn't adequate control over this agency. Here, the GPF was initially managed by Data Management for a period of 5 years. Then it was run by their IMDG, where, again, there wasn't openness to exactly what's happening with the entity.
They went in and swept those people out.
They went in and swept those.
Doesn't that show control?
Well,
it may have been a little bit of mismanagement, but it seems to me it shows control.
And then that leads to the next part, which is that the lender then issues a notice of default and takes control over the entity for a year.
But your opposition, Mr. Smith, said if you look at that, you have to look at the fact that it was waived. You can't have it both ways. You can't look at one and not the other.
I agree that that's relevant to the analysis, but I think the fact that a third-party entity came in and took control over the entity for a period of a year weighs heavily against tribal control over the entity. And I think that, again, the timing of the waiver, the court should look at that skeptically, because it came days after the district court ruled that there wasn't any tribal immunity for GPF.
Well, it's clearly strategic, but it doesn't mean that it's ineffective.
True. What
isn't your better argument that it's evanescent and they could pull the rug out tomorrow?
Yes, and that's what the district court pointed out, is that there's nothing in the waiver that prevents them from, again, going in and submitting a notice of default once the case is ended, that prevents them from doing a notice of default again in the future. So the waiver of default, again, I think the court should look at it skeptically and as a tactic in this case, more so than any sort of significant shift in the relationship between Newport funding, the tribe, and GPF. On the issue of profits.
If they hadn't declared an event of default, you concede that the tribe would be entitled to immunity?
No. Because,
why not?
Because, again, the history there, previous management by a non-tribal entity, mismanagement by IMDG, which prevented the tribe from having oversight over the financial handlings of GPF, and the fact that Newport Funding, through its lending agreement, has so much control over both the tribe's ability to...
So your argument is once Newport Funding got them to sign this financing agreement, that was the end of tribal immunity?
I think that's evidence that the tribe has not had significant control over GPF for this court to find.
Well, when you say they hadn't had significant control, you were talking about mismanagement. And as Judge Fisher pointed out, mismanagement isn't the same thing as lack of control. It's, in fact, if somebody's mismanaging an organization, by definition, they're controlling it. That's why you're blaming them for mismanagement. So are you equating mismanagement with absence of control?
Let me cite the Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court case about Miami, about the Miami lending agency. They talked about passive control, that passive control is insufficient for to find that element satisfies the breakthrough test. And that's what I think. Yes, there was mismanagement, but the mismanagement, I don't think is determinative in one way or the other. It's the fact that this mismanagement was allowed to take place in the first place. And that's because the tribe did not have access to the full financial records, did not have access to third-party lending agreements, and apparently there was some sort of internal financial.
But they have it now.
They have it now, subject to the lending agreement.
Back to my question to Mr. Smith, when is now now? What period of time do we look at here?
Well, clearly at the time that the motion to dismiss is resolved by the district court.
All right, but now we're before the Court of Appeals.
Well, and the only reason that evidence came in is based on a motion to reconsider. So I think this court...
So it did come in through the motion to reconsider.
Right.
Okay.
And so I think...
And the district court still had jurisdiction. Yeah.
Correct. And so I think that plays into it. And at some point, clearly, there has to be an end to this analysis. Otherwise, whatever change happens to the management structure...
I feel like you're playing whack-a-mole.
Right, exactly. And plus, it puts the plaintiff in a disadvantage because tribal immunity, it provides the plaintiff with an opportunity to conduct discovery, which we were able to do. And that's why we have this full record before the court. You know, if they bring it up on a motion to reconsider, we ask for discovery on you know, we have our hands tied behind our back because we don't know exactly what happened with the waiver, we know who signed the waiver now, but we don't know what happened in the interim between the motion to dismiss and the signing of the waiver.
Could I ask you about the purpose factor here? You know, how much weight do we put on their, we'll see whether they've ever paid any money over. You can tell me your understanding of the record on that point. I've asked for the citations on rebuttal, but in the meantime, how can we tell if an entity was never meant to benefit a tribe or just hasn't turned a profit?
It is a tricky question. In this case, however, is fairly simple. The corporate representative for GPF said that it was structured to provide revenue for the non-tribal manager and the non-tribal servicer with no need for Great Plains to retain profitability. Okay. That's
so their the point is those things come off the top.
I agree, yes. And they will argue that, well, that was the original arrangement and that since then it's changed. But if you look at their arrangements with Newport Funding and with Carmel Solutions, it's the same deal. There's no need for GPF to retain profitability. All the revenues are siphoned into non-tribal entities. And that's why the record has no evidence that GPF has ever created a profit, ever shared any of its money with the tribe.
I don't know if there's anything in the record on this, probably not, but I'm curious why, if this is so disadvantageous to a tribe would ever do it. There has to be something in it for the tribe, even if you're correct that the structure of the arrangement between Newport and the tribal entities is ineffective to maintain tribal immunity. What's in it for the tribe? There's got to be some reason why they would engage in this arrangement.
So generally with the rent-a-tribe scheme, the way it works is there is some sort of pittance paid to the tribe. Again, there is no evidence that pittance was paid to IMDG or the tribe in this case, but that's usually the way that it's structured.
Well, who would do all this work for a pittance? I mean... The elephant in the room is sort of an implicit accusation of bribery or corruption. I mean, somebody's making money somewhere to do this, right? And I mean, is that Is that your theory of the case?
Not necessarily bribery. I think that's a harsh accusation to make. What we have here is the contractual relationships between the parties and lack of any financial.
Who's getting paid and why? I guess your answer is you don't know.
We don't know
what
the benefit is to the tribe.
Well, the benefit to the tribe, even if assume in the history of this that there has not really been any cash turned back to the tribe. The declarations show that there have been members of the tribe who have been employed by GPF.
So the record,
that a benefit?
Sorry, Your Honor. The record shows that GPF has never had any employees. What was submitted by GPF is that sometimes they lease employees
from
IMDG. But are those tribal members?
Tribal members. The record says they are tribal members.
Yes, but the court pointed out that the affidavit, which is, again, bare bones and self-serving, doesn't identify how many employees, when these employees were leased, whether they are non-tribal members or tribal members. And again, I think there's an issue with the term leasing employees to GPF, because first off, it's not entirely clear what employees GPF would even need. GPF has a servicer that takes care of the loans. It's an online payday loan business, so it's not like it has any sort of physical location that needs to be manned. And again, lease suggests that there is money being transferred from GPF to IMDG. And there is no record of any money being transferred from GPF to IMDG or GPF to the tribe.
It says 243 are enrolled tribal members of IMDG.
And IMDG is a separate business from GPF.
Right, but they exist to oversee these private entities.
Yes, and there are, and that's where I think there is confusion here with the way that the affidavit's been structured. There's IMDG, there is then for the tribal lending business, GVA, which is a holding company.
Right.
And then there are several tribal lending agents or entities, one of which is GPF.
Right.
And so when they say we lease employees to the tribal lending entities, it's not entirely clear. Does that include GPF? Again, when they say that we derive most of our profits from tribal lending, does that include GPF? Because there are no records to show that it does specifically.
They seem to be intentionally vague about that. The use of the phrase tribal entities is capacious and doesn't tell us anything at all about GPF per se.
That's correct. And in the cases that we cited, especially in situations where the contracts kind of dispute the statements made in the affidavit, courts have required more specificity as to, you know, financial benefits, employment benefits, things of those nature. I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Baczynski. We'll hear rebuttal from Mr. Smith.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Smith, there seems to be a lot of uncertainty here as to the record. You know, not every immunity argument's decided at the motion to dismiss stage. We have qualified immunity questions that are raised at summary judgment. Do we have enough on the record to make a decision here?
You do have enough on the record, Your Honor. And so let me respond to to your inquiry, Judge Bevis. So there's a couple of places in the record that I would point you to. I was correct. It was the declaration of Evan Azure. So in the in the record before this court, it would be page A94.
JA894?
Yes. And paragraph 16 of Mr. Azure's declaration, I will concede, does not say the amount of profits, but does say, quote, since 2017, all of GPF's cash profitability has gone to IMDG. No other third party receives any profit share or transaction-based compensation from GPF.
It doesn't tell me that there's a non-zero amount there. It just says no one else is getting it.
That's correct. It does not tell you that there is not a non-zero amount, but again, as I indicated, other courts reviewing this, looking at that profitability question, have not found that profitability weighs on sovereign immunity. There's not a sliding scale of immunity based on whether a business is profitable or not. I would also like to point the court to two other places in the record. A91, the same declaration from Mr. Azure, states that online consumer lending generates 90% of IMDG's revenue. And he further indicates that without that revenue, the revenue that IMDG distributes to the tribe would decline drastically. I would also point your
IMDG
honors.
IMDG is lawyer acronym for Island Mountain, correct?
That is correct.
You are invited to speak English in this court.
Yes, Your Honor. IMDG is Island Mountain Development Group. It is a tribally owned entity that manages the lending facilities.
Okay.
I apologize. And then one other place in the record I would point Your Honor to would be A163, which is the declaration from the tribe's president, Mr. Stiffarm, who at paragraph 8 indicates that the revenues from Island Mountain Development Group are the tribe's largest source of non-federal funding, typically accounting for approximately 75% of the total non-federal budget. I want to talk about a couple of other things that my colleague raised. First, the leasing of employees. There is evidence in the record that those employees are leased solely from Island Mountain Development Group. So Great Plains is fulfilling its purpose by paying money to Island Mountain to lease those employees, a percentage of which are tribal members.
All right, so that's a benefit as a jobs program, even if there's no profits from the entity.
Absolutely, Your Honor, that is a benefit.
At least people are getting employment.
Which is a critical issue on a rural reservation.
I guess it goes back to my simple question that you gave a one-word answer to and moved on, which is okay. But is there enough in the record? I mean, Island Mountain Development, is one entity. We're talking about Great Plains Finance, which is another entity. And when I look at this record, and the declarations are perhaps some of the best record that we have here, it seems to me there's a lot of unclarity as to what goes on in between. You talk about the employees of IMDG, but there's nothing in here that shows how many of them work for GPF, unless I'm missing that.
No, that you are correct, Your Honor. That is not in the record. But I stand by my prior answer, that there is enough in the record to find that the way Great Plains is managed and the benefits that it does provide to Island Mountain Development Group support the second breakthrough and the fifth breakthrough factor. I see my time is up. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. The court will take the case under advisement.